Chapter 19. Dave jogged warily over to where the control group of humans was being kept, with Jates and Dahl down in the bunker to access the research lab's computers and Shauna providing cover for the Giraptha. Perkins had ordered Dave and Jesse to check out the ruined and smoking dropship hangar to assure there weren't any more surprises waiting for the assault team, then to make contact with the Keepers. Secretly, he had been hoping that entire group of assholes had been killed during the attack so they wouldn't be his problem. But no such luck. The control group was being held in a fenced area separated from the rest of the base by a wide, flat, open stretch of ground, and as he ran across it, Dave saw the open ground had been bulldozed flat. The Kristang had created a killing ground between their base and where the Keepers were kept. That told him just how much the Keepers were valued and trusted.
"Jesse, man, check it out."
Dave pointed with his rifle as he approached the fence.
"That's some serious security."
The Keepers were surrounded not only by a fence with clouds of razor wire on top. The fence was a double layer, with a spike-filled trench separating the fences by 4 meters. Jesse halted, bent down to pick up a stone, and tossed it at the outer fence. There was a shower of sparks, and the stone was thrown back.
"That fence must have an independent power source. Hell, we need to turn that off."
The only way in was a road that spanned the trench, with gates in the fence. Inside the fence, Keepers were peeking out from the side of the 3 buildings in the center, presumably where the control group lived. One of the buildings was nothing more than a prefab metal hut for storing something. The other 2 had windows with people's faces visible. With them wearing Ruhar skin suits and their helmets on, there was no way for the Keepers to know the base had not been assaulted by Ruhar. Even Sergeant Jates wore Ruhar flexible armor, so there was no way to see he was Kristang. And clearly their dropship was a Ruhar craft.
"I don't know how to turn off the electricity, but I do know how to open these gates."
Dave flicked off his rifle safety, took aim, and fired a maser beam at the top hinge of the outer gate. Jesse joined him, working on the lower hinge, and soon the gate sagged and crashed to the ground. Dave sliced away power cables and kicked a stone at the gate with his boot. The stone clattered and bounced off the gate, but there were no sparks. Being careful not to touch the live fence on either side, they dragged the gate out of the way and repeated the procedure with the inner gate, kicking it inside the compound with their power-assisted legs.
"Come on out, y'all,"
Jesse called out, irritated with the Keepers for hanging back.
Didn't those dumbasses know that if the attackers wanted them dead, the dropship could have strafed the compound and killed every one of them?
"Come out, you bunch of cowards!"
At one side of a barracks, there was an animated conversation, with raised voices and a scuffle. One of the people broke free and ran toward the 2 suited figures, then stopped, looked behind himself, and continued walking forward slowly. 6 other people hurried forward and caught up to him. One put a hand on the lead guy's shoulder, but he shook it off. Most of the Keepers were wearing baseball caps and bush hats against the bright morning sunlight, with others protecting their heads with rags wrapped around their skulls. All of them were dressed in relatively new, if dirty, clothing. The hats still had visible UNEF logos, although most of the logos had been defaced in some way. Dave and Jesse looked at each other. Where had the Keepers gotten new gear? The last time either of them saw a UNEF baseball cap, the blue material had faded to a light gray. And boots. All the Keepers were wearing nice boots that hadn't been patched and mended 6 times.
"Hello,"
the lead guy spoke, holding up one hand and taking his cap off with the other.
"What the f—"
"Eric,"
Jesse exclaimed.
"Jesus,"
Dave gasped, astonished.
"Eric Koblenz?"
The guy shaded his eyes but could not see the faces inside the opaque helmets. Dave and Jesse ordered their faceplates to go clear, and Eric's eyes bulged.
"Ski? Cornpone? What the hell? What? How are you here?"
he sputtered.
"That's Dave and Jesse to you, asshole,"
Dave growled. Even at tiny Fort Rakovsky, they had not liked that jerk referring to them by nicknames.
"Hell, you call us Sergeants Coulter and Chaika,"
Jesse corrected his friend, and tapped the U.S. Army chevron and rocker symbol on his shoulders.
"Sergeants?"
Eric looked closer and saw the familiar rank symbols.
He should have noticed that right away. Those were not Ruhar insignia.
What are you doing here? In hamster armor?
We'll ask the questions here, Dave snapped. We're part of a Ruhar task force now, he fibbed. Before he could brag like he greatly wanted to, Eric interrupted.
Guys, please. You have to get me out of here. Please.
His eyes were pleading, his hands held out in supplication.
The lizards lied to us. I think they used us for medical experiments. We were...
Yeah, no shit, Sherlock, Jesse cut him off. Y'all were brought here as guinea pigs. The lizards made a bioweapon to use against our people on Paradise, and you all were part of it.
We didn't know, Eric protested. They only told us...
Don't listen to their lies,
a man behind Eric growled as he reached out to pull the now reluctant keeper backwards. But Eric was not going for that shit. Not anymore. His elbow shot back and cracked the man in the face, breaking his nose and sending a spray of blood to splatter Eric. Two others stepped in, though hesitantly and without enthusiasm. Eric punched one of them, and they backed off, holding up their hands to signal they were not participating in this fight. Then Eric went crazy. The man whose nose he had broken was on the ground, rolling to his feet, when a savage kick to the ribs from Eric's boot knocked him back down. Seeing a red haze of anger in his vision, Eric Koblenz kicked the man over and over.
Don't you ever touch me again, you son of a bitch. I'm sick. Sick of your goddamn lies. Jesus!
He aimed a particularly savage kick at the man's bloody face.
You made me betray my friends, you fucking piece of shit!
Whoa. Whoa, settle down there, Koblenz. Jesse surprised himself by stepping forward and restraining the enraged former soldier. For a second, Jesse thought Eric would lash out at him, but the man collapsed to his knees, sobbing. Ski. Jesse had no idea what to do. A little help here? Dave gestured with his rifle to move the others back. He half-turned his back on the injured man who was lying prone, but the enhanced peripheral vision of his helmet alerted him to danger when the bloodied man pulled a fabric-wrapped shiv from a pocket and lunged at Eric. Reflexively, Dave shot the would-be assailant in the gut with a maser beam, his powered suit legs lifting him up and backwards clear of the man's reach. Holy sh... Jesse pulled Eric out of the way, his power-assisted arm sending Eric rolling across the dusty ground. Harder than he intended, Jesse stomped on the assailant's knife hand, hearing and feeling bones crunch.
Ugh!
The would-be assailant groaned.
Shit, that hurts, you goddamn hamster lover!
You gonna settle down and cooperate? Jesse asked, with his rifle muzzle pointed straight at the asshole's broken nose.
Fuck you, traitor!
The man spat blood on Jesse's legs. Eh, wrong answer. Jesse squeezed the trigger, having selected the undermounted railgun. An explosive-tipped flechette dart sped out, not having time to deploy its guidance fins before burying itself in the man's skull and exploding. Jesse wiped blood and gore off his helmet, kicking the headless body away in disgust. He turned to the shocked faces of the crowd that had assembled around them. Anybody else got smart-ass remarks you want to try on me? No? Because this counter... He turned the rifle so the crowd could see the display on top of his rifle. Says I got 19 more explosive darts in the magazine, plus like 100 maser shots left in the power cell. Coulter. Chaika. Perkins's voice came over their helmet speakers. I heard weapons fire. You both okay? We're fine, Colonel, Dave replied. We got some keepers here who are having second thoughts about their loyalty to the lizards. They giving you trouble? No, ma'am. It's the idiots who are not having second thoughts who are causing a ruckus. There's one less of them now. Understood. Chaika, be careful, especially of the ones who want out. This will be the second time they've changed sides. They might be looking for a convenient opportunity to flip loyalties again. Copy that. Colonel, one of the guys who regrets coming here is a guy Jesse and I knew way back from our farm village in Lemuria. What are the odds, right? You trust him? Not as far as I could throw him, Dave snorted, then remembered he was wearing an advanced technology power-assisted skin suit. I throw him on my own, I mean. He was an asshole back then, but Jesse and I think this guy joined the Keepers because he was stupid, and he listened to the wrong people. Be careful anyway. I think the headless horseman here,
Dave looked down so Perkins could see the shattered body through his helmet camera. It's discouraging any moron to a feeling adventurous.
Ma'am, Jesse called out, jogging out of the keeper compound, waving something in one hand.
Colonel, look, they've got UNEF ration packs. Lots of them. There's a whole building full of human food and uniforms and all kinds of UNEF stuff inside the fence where that control group is living.
MREs? Perkins caught the package Jesse tossed to her. Beef stroganoff? Beef. She had not eaten beef, real beef, in years. The cultured, lab-grown beef substitute provided by the Ruhar as an experiment was tasty, if a bit bland, and still in short supply.
Huh. She read the label. This is still good. It hasn't expired yet.
I don't know if it was good when it was fresh, ma'am, but they've got crates of MREs and other rations in one of the buildings here.
He jerked a thumb over one shoulder behind him. Dave was back making sure the keepers didn't do anything stupid, to the Mavericks or to themselves, while Jesse reported to Perkins.
Goddamn lizards were holding out on us, and the dumb keepers here were eating like kings compared to us on Paradise. Hell, I half-starved on corn and taters in Lemuria, and the lizards probably had warehouses, entire starships full of supplies.
When the hamsters took Paradise back, whatever human food the Kristang were shipping to Paradise might have gotten dumped here, Perkins speculated.
Jesse shook his head once angrily. No way. We stopped getting supplies from Earth before the hamsters took the planet back. That's why Bishop had the cushy job of planting potatoes, remember?
Perkins did remember that time, but her memories were different. We were still getting supplies shipped in from home back then, at a lower rate, but steady. HQ slow-rolled distribution to the field because they wanted to build up a stockpile to get us through lean times.
HQ was holding out on us?
They weren't holding out, Coulter. The lizards had warned us we needed to become self-sufficient. They were tired of footing the bill for shipping everything we needed all the way from Earth. Even before the Ruhar arrived to retake the planet, the lizards told us the Force would not be going straight back to Earth, even after we got the last hamster off the planet. Our guess back then was the White Wind Clan planned to pimp us out again to another clan.
Another evac op?
No. Perkins wanted to spit, but couldn't inside her sealed-up helmet. HQ figured we most likely would be used as cannon fodder in battles between clans.
Oh, hell. Damn. So we got lucky when the hamster fleet showed up. Can we bring ration packs back with us?
Perkins looked at the dropship, sitting with its back ramp open.
Any supplies we take from here may be contaminated, but we'll need to scrub the inside of the dropship anyway before we can take these suits off.
All right, Coulter. There's plenty of space and storage lockers aboard the dropship. Cram in whatever you can fit. And do us a favor. If you see any Chinese ration packs that are labeled something like pickled herring, leave them and take something else.
I can't read Chinese.
Jesse wasn't sure if his CO was joking or not. Perkins tapped her visor.
Your helmet translator can.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Jesse's face turned red inside his helmet.
Take Jarrett with you. She told me she's not being much help to Jates, and he doesn't need anyone to cover him. That research bunker is empty.
Yes, ma'am. Shauna, come on up here. We got work to do. It's dinner time.
We have trouble, Jates
shouted while running out of the underground bunker, waving a tablet at Perkins.
What, a ship jumped in?
She shuddered as a jolt of fear ran up her spine. Her body was just coming down off the adrenaline high of combat. Now she felt her heart racing again. Although, her mind flashed, why? If an enemy ship was now above them, there was absolutely nothing she could do about it.
No. Worse.
Worse? What the hell could be—
Jates cut her off.
Dahl just found out this base is programmed to self-destruct. The crew must have activated that sequence before the last one of them died.
Okay. Shit.
She glanced quickly around. They had one dropship, no motorized vehicles, and no spare skin suits that could speed a person's escape.
Did you get the data we need?
Jake held up something that looked like a shiny metallic sphere the size of a softball.
This is the memory core. Dahl says we can access it through dropship computers. Colonel, we have the keys to decrypt the data, but there were not any samples of the pathogen in the research lab. The researchers took everything with them, or they destroyed all their samples before they left.
Damn it. Could we, or the Ruhar, synthesize the pathogen from the data you retrieved?
I do not know. We will need to decrypt all the data first. Colonel, I do know we must leave here immediately.
We need to get these idiot keepers moving, then. They can head toward...
Colonel Perkins, there is no time for anyone to walk out to a safe distance. Under the base is a multi-megaton atomic compression device. It must have been provided by the Theranin, or possibly the Bosphorok. The warrior caste wishes to erase all signs of their illegal activity here.
A nuke? That's against the rules.
She meant the rules of engagement enforced by the two senior species and the Endless War, rules intended to prevent lesser beings from contaminating life-sustaining biospheres. Biological warfare is also a violation of the rules, but that pathogen will be used against a populated world with a healthy biosphere. Technically, atomic compression devices are not considered nukes because they do not create long-lasting radioactive fallout. Colonel, regarding the rules, setting off a single nuclear device here would probably not provoke a reaction, because one such weapon would not significantly damage a world that is already doomed. The variable star will render this planet uninhabitable within the next 3,000 years.
Oh, hell. How big an explosion and how much time do we have? Scratch that. Is there any way we can shut it down?
No, to your final question. The device is buried in a hardened canister, and any unauthorized attempt to access the canister will cause immediate detonation. The self-destruct mechanism is simple and rugged. Dahl says he does not know any way to hack into it. Once the mechanism was activated, it cuts itself off from further instructions.
God damn it!
To answer your other question, the device is powerful enough to obliterate everything in this valley. We need to be behind that ridge. He pointed to the mountain peaks that rimmed the bowl-shaped valley. When the device explodes and... He checked his tablet. 12 minutes and 49 seconds.
Strebitch!
Perkins roared and twirled one finger over her head in a spin-up motion the former Blackhawk pilot knew well.
We are leaving!
Except they couldn't.
Ma'am.
Irene's hands shook from emotion as she explained the problem in a whisper.
We can't take all these people with us. They won't all fit. And with the ship carrying that much mass...
She shot a fearful look at the lowest point of the surrounding ridge.
We won't clear the ridge. I'm sorry. We only have one engine to provide power. We can't take all these people.
Her eyes darted to the cluster of keepers who had been herded together.
Strebitch, we are not leaving any humans to die here, you got that? Strip this thing of anything you can toss out the door fast, and we will make room.
Colonel, Derek pled his case. She's right. There simply is not enough space inside the cabin for all these people.
He hoped their commanding officer did not make a foolish request like strapping people to the dodo's stubby wings.
If we stack people in on top of each other, we can...
He ran a quick estimate in his head.
Fit most of them. We would still be leaving a dozen or more.
The cabin. Perkins appraised the dropship's cramped interior, designed to hold only 14 troops.
Wait, your Winchester on missiles?
Yes, we launched our full weapons load in the raid. Derek answered warily.
Can we put people in the missile bays if they use oxygen masks?
I wouldn't recommend that, Derek replied as he shared an alarmed look with Irene.
Screw the recommendation. Can we do it?
We can try, Irene agreed quickly, hoping to end the discussion before Perkins thought up an even worse idea.
Jarrett, Coulter, Chaika, we need to strip out the cabin seats now.
They got 5 very frightened people stuffed into each of the 2 empty missile bays, but the simple expedient of explaining their choice was a few minutes of discomfort or dying in a nuclear fireball. 3 keepers still refused the evac orders, protesting that they remained loyal to the Kristang and would not cooperate with their supposed rescuers. Perkins ended that rebellion with a rifle butt to the face of one protester, ordering his unconscious form dropped unceremoniously on the bottom of the pile in the cabin.
Seriously?
Shauna cocked her head at one still protesting asshole.
I would be more than happy to shoot you right now.
There is no nuke, the asshole spat at her. Unless you planted it to cover evidence of your attack on our allies, you traitorous bitch.
7 minutes, Irene screamed through the dropship's doorway. We need to go now.
Bitch. Shauna's grip tightened on her rifle. You might...
The argument ended abruptly when Jesse casually shot a maser beam through the protester's right thigh. Then, when the keeper slumped to the ground, kicked him hard under the chin.
Grab an arm. We'll drag Sleeping Beauty here into the ship, he ordered, and began pulling the unconscious asshole up the ramp, which was beginning to cycle closed. Asshole's head lolled to the side, but as the maser had cauterized the leg wound, there was little blood. Shauna grabbed the other arm and they tumbled inside, rolling the idiot into one of the last spaces available and sitting on top of him, as there was no other place to go with the closing ramp squashing them together.
Nobody calls me a bitch.
Shauna sat down on the protester, not making any effort to be gentle.
You think that's important right now? Jesse asked as he safed his rifle and looked for something to hang on to.
The pilots had the dropship off the ground and wobbling as it struggled to gain altitude on one engine.
Oh, this is not good,
Irene gritted her teeth.
Colonel, I don't know about this.
The Kristang research base was in a high mountain valley on a planet with a thin atmosphere, and the lowest point of the ridge around them was over 22,000 feet high. If both engines had been healthy, the dropship could have easily made it into orbit, even overloaded as it was. With only a single damaged engine generating less than half its normal peak power, the craft was struggling to climb at all. Ruhar dropships had supplemental booster packs that could be installed under the wings to provide a one-time surge of thrust for heavyweight takeoffs, but none of those packs had been brought down to the planet. Irene would not have brought them into combat anyway, as having volatile booster packs slung under the wings was just asking for trouble in a situation where the dropship had been shot at.
We're at 18,000 and we can barely maintain that.
Can we circle back, fly a longer route to gain altitude? Perkins suggested.
Distance won't help, ma'am.
Irene told herself to be patient with their non-pilot commander.
It's simple math. We're too heavy for the power available.
She kept the I-told-you-so tone out of her voice, but that wasn't easy.
Part of the problem is there's a strong wind coming from the direction of the gap we're trying to fly through. It's creating a downdraft on this side of the ridge. That gap is the lowest point on this side of the rim. Next low point is over 1,000 feet higher.
We don't have time anyway to change course at this point, Derek warned.
Perkins debated an idea she hated. She had stubbornly insisted on taking every single person with them, and now her refusal to consider immovable facts might kill them all. In a flash, she remembered allowing her team to stuff lockers full of food packages, and she had not seen MREs among the seats and other gear stripped out of the ship.
Could we lighten our load?
Not at this point, ma'am, Irene explained.
Opening a ramp would spoil our aerodynamics and cause us to drop. By the time we got the ramp closed and climbed, it would be too late.
I'm sorry. I don't see we have any good options, she declared,
as her eyes flitted rapidly across the display in front of her. Maybe below them was a canyon or an arm of a mountain they could land behind and shelter from the nuclear shockwave.
I'm going to try something, Derek announced as he flipped a switch to take command. My aircraft.
What are you doing?
Irene's voice was unsteady as a sudden jolt hit the airspace craft. The jolt caused her stomach to do flip-flops. They were dropping.
The only thing I can think of.
Derek didn't take his eyes off the instruments. With one hand, he was playing with the throttle.
Not this. Whatever you're doing, it's not working.
The other thing had no chance, Derek replied evenly.
I'm watching the fan blade pitch.
You call out the climb rate indicator?
Irene glared at the other pilot but kept one eye on the instruments. Ruhar airspace craft did not have the ability for pilots to manually adjust the pitch of the engine fan blades, a feature both humans found limiting and annoying. Instead, the flight computer set the angle at which the turbine fan blades bit into the air based on speed and power settings. To Irene's amazement, Derek's action of reducing throttle had the effect of deepening the pitch, and she watched fearfully as the altimeter steadied, then began slowly increasing. She sucked in a breath, unwilling to speak lest she jinx their temporary good luck.
We are climbing.
When the rate of climb reached 700 feet per minute, she announced that fact.
And now 850 per minute. Rate of increase is slowing, but... Derek, how did you know?
Something I read in a book about aviation in World War II when they were still figuring out the principles of aerodynamics. I knew the computer adjusts this ship's blade pitch based on power settings, so I hoped reducing power would drop our airspeed and make the blades take a bigger bite of air to compensate. We did lose airspeed, but we don't give a shit about that now. We're climbing at our best velocity, and that's the best we can do. Are we going to clear the ridge in time?
Irene ran a quick estimate.
With 40 seconds to spare at this rate.
Outstanding. Perkins exhaled in relief behind them. Perhaps her stubbornness had not killed them. This time. That was a lesson she needed to remember. They cleared the ridge, having to battle strong and gusty winds as they approached and flew through the gap. On the other side, Derek dipped the nose and advanced the throttles, trading altitude for airspeed in an effort to put distance between them and the coming shockwave. He dove and turned gently to the right, getting clear of the gap behind them, for that is where the shockwave would come through first and with the most energy.
4 seconds, Irene called out, and polarized all the portholes to avoid people being blinded. 2. 1.